History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening. Welcome to the History Show here on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, we'll be looking ahead to some of the many significant and interesting anniversaries that will fall during the coming year. 1918, of course, saw a momentous general election in Ireland, a conscription crisis, the introduction of voting rights for women on these islands, and the outbreak of the deadly Spanish flu, so called. Aside from the events of 1918, we'll also be looking at other anniversaries which are coming up in this new year, including some of the many important events of 1968, a tumultuous year of protest around the world, notably in the USA. I'm joined this evening by Mark Duncan, Director of Century Ireland, Daniel Geary, Associate Professor in American History at Trinity College in Dublin, and Catherine McSharry of the National Library of Ireland. And Catherine, you're going to begin in 1918 with one significant event that you've chosen, which is the publication of the book Married Love by Mary Stopes, something which caused huge controversy at the time.
It did indeed. So in a year when the women first received the vote, I think this was another important moment. Mary Stopes was an intriguing figure. She was one of the first academics in the University of Manchester. But she wrote Married Love, she said, after her first marriage fell apart, because in my own marriage, I paid such a terrible price for sex ignorance that I feel that knowledge gained at such a cost should be placed at the service of humanity. So basically what she was saying in Married Love is healthy relationships between men and women depended on equality, on sexual pleasure, and on the availability of birth control. As you can imagine, it was pretty shocking. As you can also imagine, it sold out within the first 2 weeks and was republished six more times before the end of the year.
And it was banned as well. Was it banned actually in the UK? It's already banned in Ireland, and I know it was banned in the USA.
It was banned in the USA, that's right. And later on, actually, several of Mary Stopes' works were banned when we introduced censorship in 1929.
I mean, Mary Stopes is most associated, I suppose, with the Stopes clinics. Are they just called after her, or do we know, did she have anything to do with the establishment of those clinics?
So there's not a direct line of descent, but she did set up clinics in London in order to put in place family planning, particularly for married women. She was interested in birth control as a measure for equality. There was also a less savoury end to it. She certainly was interested in eugenics, and she was concerned that what she would have considered the less desirable elements of the population were overbreeding.
So she wanted certain people to be bred out of the human race, basically.
Exactly. So you might say doing the right thing for what we might well consider the wrong ends.
OK, Mark, 1918, the parliamentary party leader John Redmond died in March 1918. At that stage, did he have any political influence left?
It had certainly been waning. Obviously, the year before, you had a string of Sinn Féin electoral successes and by-elections. That momentum behind Sinn Féin had begun to slow slightly in the early months. They had a number of reversals, some in constituencies they might not have expected to win, but they still lost out to the Irish Parliamentary Party in places like South Armagh. Obviously, when Redmond died, his son succeeded him in taking his Waterford seat and East Tyrone. But he was an absent figure. Due to illness, he had basically absented himself from the Irish Convention. Dennis Quinn, who wrote a biography of him in the early 1930s, said in early 1918, he was not yet 62, but he had the appearance of an old and broken man, someone who had been broken by the responsibilities that weighed upon him.
Also mourning the death of his brother in 1917.
Absolutely. That was obviously the year before. What's interesting, I think, is the funeral and the response to his death. He is brought to Westminster Cathedral. There is Lloyd George, Bonner Law, the King sends a representative. But there are also about 3,500 people who file past his coffin. The coffin is draped in an Irish flag, or at least it was a flag donated by the United Irish League in London. What happened in London, though, was very much, I think the Freeman's Journal recall, that was basically, you know, for the nations to honour him. When he came home to Ireland and he was there was the ceremony in Wexford, Wexford was draped in black flags. It was very quiet. It was a very, very dignified ceremony. And an awful lot of the editorials around the time are concerned about the judgment of history. How will he be remembered? And there is also that sense that, you know, his star has fallen. They believe that in time, people would actually come to honour him for the statesman that he was and for what he achieved in his lifetime. That wasn't obvious, of course, in 1918.
Hasn't really happened yet either. I would venture to suggest.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, if you're thinking about it, at the beginning of 1914, where Nationalist Ireland is living in the expectancy that Home Rule is about to be introduced, you know, you have torch-lit processions greeting the new year, editorials and an awful lot of the local press. People believe that Redmond is about to deliver. Events get in the way, huge events to which he doesn't really respond. And partly that, one reason for that, I suppose, is that he's absent. He's in Westminster. He's out of touch. And that is one of the great criticisms of the Irish Parliamentary Party. But he has, up to that point, he's prevented the introduction of conscription to Ireland. Of course, he is spared the indignity of its ultimate introduction, which is just the month after his death.
OK, so talk to me about then conscription. This crisis explodes a month after the death of Redmond. They introduce it in April of 1918. What happens?
It has been in the background. Ulster Unionists, Southern Unionists have been pressing for the extension of conscription to Ireland. When it was introduced in for the rest of Britain in 1916, Ireland is left out, and for very good reason. They believe it would do more harm than good. It would only be introduced with the consent that was never likely to come anyway. Lord Londonderry is speaking in Westminster in 1917, urging the British government to extend it to Ireland. Carson travels Ulster in February of 1918, urging the extension to Ireland. It doesn't happen. Why does it change? Why does the British government policy change? It changes because of a series of reversals on the Western Front. Germany starts making advances and it frightens them. It frightens them into extending the terms of conscription that applies already in Britain. So men from 21 to 41 were eligible for conscription up to that point. Now it extends to 51 and then they extend it to Ireland. And what that does is it creates a pan-nationalist response. You have the Labour movement, the Irish Parliamentary Party, Sinn Féin, the Catholic hierarchy come in to oppose it. You know, within days of its introduction in April, you have an all-party anti-partition committee being established in the Mansion House. Within days of that, you have an anti-conscription pledge being signed outside churches around Ireland. You know?
Also, the role of Labour is often overlooked during this period. Labour are crucial when it comes to the opposition to conscription.
Absolutely, because they organise a general strike. It is an important demonstration of defiance, of Irish defiance. AJP Taylor, renowned English historian, said that the conscription crisis is when Britain loses Ireland. You could argue they'd already lost Ireland up to that point, but it does indicate the seriousness of the issue in Ireland.
Mm. Dan, in January 1918, Woodrow Wilson, the president of the USA, outlines his famous 14 points, which is the basis, the template that he wants to be used for post-World War I negotiations. What was his plan? What was his plan for peace? I mean, he was hoping, I think, also to bring about peace using the 14 points. And what then was his template for the future after the war?
Yeah, well, Wilson had gone into the war saying that it would be the war to end all wars. I mean, he was speaking to an American public that's skeptical of getting involved in just conflict among European nationalisms. You know, so Wilson wants a sort of a liberal democratic order to come out of this war. To that end, he proposes a League of Nations. He says that colonial people should have a say in how the lines will be redrawn after the war. And he also says that national minority should have the right to self-determination. Some of these commitments are more rhetorical than real. You know, when it comes down to it, Wilson can't get these things done in 1919. And he doesn't necessarily even mean, you know, exactly what he says to a certain extent, that he's not really, in the case of Ireland, for example, a lot of people in Ireland say, well, this is great. You know, the U.S. is going to come up with self-determination. Yeah. You know, like, we've got the U.S. support. Well, no, not really. And the same actually all around the world, you know, people who, you know, anti-colonial movements say, great, the United States is going to support us. Well, no, it doesn't really, and that wasn't necessarily Wilson's intention. But nevertheless, it does put forth a vision for the war as about something, you know? I mean, as about a different kind of world, whether you see that really as, you know, rhetoric or, you know, an actual effort to reshape things.
Now, he won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1919 for his efforts. Was that about as good as it got for Wilson when it came to the 14 points? What was the attitude of Clemenceau, who was the French Prime Minister, and Lloyd George, who was the British Prime Minister? Was it a case of good luck with that, mate?
Well, I think Lord George had announced his own aims just a few days before, which were in some ways congruent with the U.S. aims, especially in terms of of free trade and the like. But obviously there were some differences in terms of self-determination, in terms of how the colonial questions would be resolved. Clemenceau was kind of skeptical from the beginning. He famously said, 14 points, you know, the Lord only needed 10.
Catherine, in 1918, women in Ireland were given voting rights for the first time, not just in Ireland, but in Britain as well.
Yes, so some women in Britain and Ireland were given voting rights for the first time. Yeah, the Representation of the People Act was passed in 1918, and it did a number of things. It extended the franchise to men over 21, and it gave the vote to women over 30 who met certain property qualifications. Now, those property qualifications had largely been eliminated for men, so they had to be property owners, married to a property owner, a university graduate voting in a university constituency, and so on. And while that extended the franchise to 8.5 million women roughly, it still leaves out a huge number of women under the age of 30. So while it is a big step forward, it's certainly not the universal franchise that is easy to think about when we hear about the vote being extended in 1918.
And why was it that after so much pre-war resistance, so much angst, hunger strikes, axe attacks on Asquith, the Prime Minister, Emily Davison effectively committing suicide by horse at the Derby, why did it happen so apparently uncontroversially?
I think there are a few possible answers, or maybe there's a selection of variables that add up to an answer. The one that's always advanced is the idea that it was a sort of reward for good behaviour for all the work that women had done during the war. But while that's certainly a factor, it can't be the whole story because so many of the women who worked during the war were under 30 and didn't get the benefit. All that activism that happened in the run-up to the war, while it was so controversial at the time, I think it gradually was creating a process of minds changing. And I think you can also see with something like the October Revolution the previous year in Russia, the idea that if you don't introduce small-scale change, you may see socialist revolution on your hands plays into it as well. It may also be that because it's part of a package of measures, this idea of greater fairness, all of those things are starting to play in together.
Dan, same thing happens in the USA, although you had to, only had to be over 21, I think, in the USA.
Yeah, there's a constitutional amendment that is passed by the U.S. Congress and then it goes to ratification. It was ultimately ratified in 1920, saying that in some states, in fact, women already had the right to vote in the U.S.
Some of the Western states, Wyoming,
yeah, indeed, for a few decades. But it says, you know, states cannot discriminate in terms of gender on the basis of the right to vote. And I just add, you know, to the reasons for this, I think partly there's also sort of a, if you like, a political tipping point where once the idea becomes popular enough that it seems like it might happen, you know, neither party no politician wants to be the party that said, no, you can't have the vote when suddenly half their constituents are going to be women. You know, they know that this would be quite bad for them. So I think there gets a point where all the politicians kind of get on board because they don't want to be punished.
Mark, the first election in which women could vote in Ireland was a hugely significant one, the general election, which took place over a week or 10 days in December of 1918. So what happened there?
Yeah, well, this is the first election in 8 years. It is the first election under the new franchise. And it's worth bearing in mind just how transformed the Irish electorate was. It goes from 700,000 up to 2 million. So even before a vote is cast, we are likely to have, or we're living in the expectancy of, a democratic revolution. What it does is effectively obliterate the Irish Parliamentary Party. They go down from 67 seats down to 6 seats in the new Westminster Parliament.
And most of those are in Ulster, and that's by agreement, a vote sharing or non-vote splitting arrangement.
4 of 6 of those are in constituencies where Sinn Féin has stood aside. I suppose this is important to bear in mind when we look at the Sinn Féin vote. The Sinn Féin win 73 of the 103 Irish seats, but their percentage share of the vote is less than 50%. It's about 46%. It's one of those things that has thrown at Sinn Féin in the analysis of this, that they didn't actually command a majority of nationalist votes. Well, 25 of those constituencies didn't involve any electoral competition, so people weren't necessarily motivated to go out and support them. And in those 4 of six Ulster constituencies, which the Irish Parliamentary Party, they didn't compete to allow the Nationalists to defeat the Unionists.
And of course, it's the first past the post system.
It's the first past the post system. It's a very crude system. So Sinn Féin are the big winners, but so too are the Ulster Unionists. They sweep the boards in many of the constituencies in Ulster. They win 23 of the 37 seats in Ulster. So I think what that tells you is that the divides that are apparent in Irish politics in 1912 and 1913 remain the same in 1918. It's just that the Irish Parliamentary Party have been replaced by Sinn Féin. So arguably, actually, maybe they've become more entrenched, the divides, than existed in 1912, 1913.
Now, this is also a significant anniversary year for An Post, as it was 200 years ago this week that the GPO first opened for business on what was then Sackville Street. Another date that our postal service will be commemorating is the sinking of the mail boat, the RMS Leinster. That was in October of 1918, which still represents the greatest single loss of life that ever occurred in the Irish Sea. Larkin Clancy spoke to Stephen Ferguson, Assistant Secretary of An Post, and found out more about this tragedy.
The RMS Leinster was one of four ships named after the provinces of Ireland, which were owned and operated by the Dublin Steam Packet Company.
It was a passenger steamboat company, so it carried everybody, from business people, landed people, nobility, government people, across the Irish Sea, and it also then carried mail.
Since 1860, the company had the postal contract to carry the mail across the Irish Sea.
The ships were extremely reliable, they were technologically innovative, and they took great pride in their operation, both on the postal side and as being a premier ship for people to cross, particularly the Leinster.
When the First World War began, like many large ships, the Leinster was drafted in to help carry troops. All civilian business took a back seat to the war effort. On the 10th of October 1918, on board were a mix of military personnel, passengers and postal workers.
At the time that the Leinster was sunk, there were many soldiers and officers from all over the world. There were nursing staff, there were the crew and sailors, so that it was a very mixed ship comprising many different nationalities and many different people from all sorts of different walks of life. From the German point of view, this was being used as a troop ship. It may well have been carrying other important government people. It was a legitimate target in terms of the German thinking at the time. The German submarine, under a Captain Ram, who was the commander of the submarine, he saw the Leinster. He managed to get off his torpedoes, and the ship went down very quickly.
Postal sorters and clerks from the Dublin Post Office team worked on the ship on each journey, sorting mail in an office on the bottom deck.
When the ship was struck, one of the first torpedoes actually struck our sorting office, and that was what killed most of the people in our particular crew. All but one of the 21 staff were either killed by the explosion or drowned. The sole surviving witness was able to record that the companionway, or the ladder that went from the lower deck to the upper deck, was destroyed, and there was no way for these people to escape.
The total death toll was over 500 out of about 750 people on board.
So it was a very high percentage of people who lost their lives, and the comparable disasters of the Lusitania and the Titanic, these were on the same sort of scale, but this disaster happened within sight of Dunleary, and it had an enormous impact on people. It was the numbers of people who were involved, it was the fact that it brought the war right into Ireland in a way that it hadn't before. The Leinster was a major shock for everybody. The loss of a mail boat, the loss of so many people, and the ramifications throughout the country of relatives and people who had been lost on that.
Lauchlan Clancy was reporting there. He was talking to Stephen Ferguson, Assistant Secretary of An Post, about the sinking of the mailboat, the RMS Leinster, in October 1918. And Stephen Ferguson is the author of a number of books about our nation's postal service, including the beautifully illustrated The Post Office in Ireland, An Illustrated History, as published by Irish Academic Press. An Post are issuing commemorative stamps this year to mark both the loss of the RMS Leinster in October 1918 and the opening of the GPO in January 1818. Catherine, speaking of 1818, that year a book was first published that became an absolute horror classic, Frankenstein.
Yeah, so Frankenstein was published on the 1st of January in 1818, and you could make an argument that it came into being because in 1815 there was the largest volcanic eruption in recorded history, because the year afterwards, in 1816, the weather was incredibly bad, and Mary Shelley, the author of the book, Percy Shelley and Lord Byron were all staying together in a villa on Lake Geneva. The weather was so cold and wet because of the volcano that they all started to tell each other ghost stories, and Mary Shelley came up with the idea of what went on to become Frankenstein.
She was a very interesting woman, but she also had a very interesting mother, didn't she?
Yeah, so Mary was the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft and William Godwin. And Mary Wollstonecraft was one of the earliest feminists, the author of The Vindication of the Rights of Women. And Mary herself, as a consequence, even though her mother died when she was only a very small child, had a very unconventional upbringing. So she was brought up without much reference to gender norms, and she certainly had a fairly unconventional life herself.
And was Frankenstein one of these books that sold well, that did well at the time, or was it one of these ones that in retrospect became classics, or many it took a long time, slow burners I suppose you'd call them?
Yeah, it was very extensively reviewed, including a review from Walter Scott in Blackwood's, who assumed that it was written by Shelley because it was anonymous, but it only had about 500 copies in its first printing. A lot of those copies went into circulating libraries, so it became known that way. And then there were multiple dramatised versions of it in the 1820s. And that's probably where it became the best known. And of course, that sense of it being best known in dramatic form is carried through into the cinematic versions in the 20th century.
Indeed. After the break, we will be continuing our look at important and interesting anniversaries coming up in 2018.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show here on RTE Radio 1, where we're looking at significant and interesting anniversaries coming up in 2018.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm just sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time.
Sitting on the Dock of the Bay there, released 50 years ago this week. The song was a hit single for Otis Redding shortly after his death at the age of 26. The year that song was released, 1968, the USA was rocked by the assassinations just 2 months apart of two of the most iconic American political figures of their era.
I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in.
Robert Kennedy there announcing the death of Martin Luther King during a speech in Indianapolis on the night of the 4th of April 1968. And of course, Kennedy himself would be killed by a gunman just 2 months later. Dan, we heard on that clip of Kennedy announcing the death of Martin Luther King, the shocked reaction of the crowd. What effect did those assassinations have on the American psyche, do you think?
Well, I think, I mean, you also think of other things going on at this time. I mean, the Vietnam War, public opinion turned against it. And it seemed like there was just a tremendous amount of violence in American life. And people were, I think, looking at the dark side of American history, American society, that had seen these, you know, individual acts of violence, horrific acts of violence come about. The response to the King assassination was, in many cities, rioting in African-American areas where, you know, there was a great deal of poverty, suffering of police brutality and the like. In fact, the, you know, the speech that you played about Kennedy there, it said that in Indianapolis there would have been a riot were it not for Kennedy's address, which was completely spontaneous on his part. Mm.
And of course, all of this is against the backdrop of the American presidential election. At this stage, by April of 1968, Lyndon Baines Johnson has withdrawn his candidacy. He is not going to go forward for another term. And I suppose you could say that the right wing of the Democratic Party is gathering behind Hubert Humphrey, who was the vice president. Did Robert Kennedy have a shot at winning the Democratic nomination that year? Had he survived?
Probably not, no. I mean, when he was assassinated, he had just won the primary in California. But in 1968 was the last convention the Democrats had where really it was party insiders who picked the candidate rather than a sort of open, you know, system of voting. And, you know, Humphrey had the Democratic establishment behind him, like you said, and that was enough, would be enough in 1968 to do it. And Kennedy had gotten in the race a bit late as well. Eugene McCarthy had been the one who'd pushed Johnson out. So I think it's very unlikely that Kennedy would have been the candidate in 68, although he would have had a great chance of being the candidate in 72. Mm.
And then, of course, 68 was the year of the riots in Chicago at the Democratic Party convention. And the man blamed for that to a considerable extent is the mayor of Chicago, Richard Daley.
It was. I mean, and in fact, the report that was done after called it a police riot. I mean, there were protesters there to protest the Vietnam War and the Democratic Party's role in promoting the war. But the people who were rioting were, in fact, the police. I mean, they removed their badges. They beat protesters. They beat journalists. Reacted with astonishing violence. And meanwhile, within the Democratic convention itself was coming apart as you had people who were more sympathetic with the protesters or at least horrified at what the police were doing. One a prominent Democrat said there are Gestapo tactics on the street. And Mayor Daley responded very unfavorably to that. I can't even repeat his language. Within the convention, it's coming apart as well over the issue of Vietnam and, I suppose, over the issue of the legitimacy of public protest.
Now, you would have thought in August of 1968, with the Democratic Party split down the middle, with the riotous scenes that you would have seen in Chicago, that the Republican nominee, one Richard Milhouse Nixon, was an absolute shoo-in, but he almost lost it.
It was a very close election, and some interesting materials has emerged in recent years that show that one of the reasons why Nixon won the election, perhaps the reason, is because working through Henry Kissinger, who was and later became his foreign policy advisor, he scuppered a peace deal that was on the table between the U.S. and Vietnam. Basically, what Nixon did is he, you know, had his representative, Kissinger, say to the South Vietnamese, don't sign this deal because if I win, you know, I'll keep fighting for you. Now, that is treason, effectively. And indeed, in the Johnson White House, they considered going public with this knowledge. They decided in the end not to, that it would be too controversial. But had Johnson secured a peace deal taking Vietnam off the table, it's quite possible that Humphrey would have won what was in fact a very close election.
Against somebody who was a very unpopular Republican candidate, as
indeed,
in Richard Nixon. Mark, back at home, of course, 1968 saw the outbreak of our own troubles.
And of course, it borrowed from the civil rights movement that we saw in America and elsewhere during that year. But it probably has its roots in some of the reforms that were brought in the in post-war Britain, particularly the Education Act, which helped create this Catholic middle class, which you begin to see in the mid-1960s organising itself. It begins to manifest itself in organisations like the Campaign for Social Justice in Northern Ireland, which is founded in 1964. Professional middle-class Catholic people who are publishing facts and figure, raising awareness of the level of discrimination in the north of Ireland. And in 1967, obviously, then you have the foundation of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association, which is established to pressed the case for five essential reforms, one man, one vote. In other words, that the vote was only extended to ratepayers. This was to extend it to all men and women over the age of 21. It was an end to gerrymandering, you know, that system where unionist minority controlled Catholic majority councils, an end to discrimination in housing and employment, and the abolition of the B specials. You start seeing them taking a bit more assertive action in 1968. Austin Curry famously occupies a house in Culloden, County Tyrone, after the house, the local council, awarded that house to a 19-year-old single Protestant girl who was the secretary of a local unionist councillor when Catholic families couldn't get homes. Later that year, October the 5th, 1968, is a march in Derry, which had been banned after the Loyalist Apprentice Boys organised an event for the same day. All marching was banned. It went ahead and it was met with a repressive response from the RUC. All of this was filmed and these pictures went around the world and it kind of changed public opinion. It also, I suppose, led to more militant action with the foundation of People's Democracy. Really interesting group of people, fascinating leadership, people like Michael Farrell, who was a postgraduate student in Queen's at the time, ideologically driven, very, very bright. Eamon McCann would have been involved in that, Bernadette Devlin. And they refused to accept the promise of reforms that were coming later in that year. In December 1968, Terence O'Neill had said Ulster was at the crossroad and he promised reforms as a kind of a sop to them. They didn't accept that. They organised a march from Derry to Belfast in the first 4 days of 1969, which the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association didn't want any part of it. It went ahead anyway. And of course, it met with its inevitable end in terms of a very violent response that they got.
Now, it's also 20 years since the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, Sunningdale for Slow Learners, to use Seamus Mallon's famous phrase.
Yeah, you know, we only arrive at this point after 3,500 lives are lost. Over 1,800 of those are civilians. These are people who didn't see themselves as part of anybody's war. You know, it came at great cost. And I suppose the pavestones towards the Good Friday Agreement, you can see some of them are public and political. You see them in the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 1985, the Joint Declaration at Downing Street in 1993, which recognised principles of consent and self-determination. Other steps are taken, you know, beneath the surface. They are the Hume Adams talks. They are the links between the IRA and the British government. The real impetus perhaps comes in 1997 when Tony Blair becomes British Prime Minister with a whopping majority and really, along with Bertie Ahern, drives this. And George Mitchell sets a date. Crucially, he sets a date for a conclusion of multi-party talks that were established during that decade. They don't meet that deadline. They go about 17 hours beyond it, but they do reach an agreement. It is a remarkable agreement. I suppose, you know, many of us who were kind of grown up through that time, we thought, what kind of resolution were you going to get to the Northern Ireland problem? What we ended up was not what we would have envisaged a mere 10 years before. It took into account all of the relationships, what we call the totality of relationships. So north, south, east, west, and the relationship between the two communities. And of course, it was ratified within a month. It was ratified in May 1998 in a referendum held on the same day in north and south. It didn't end the troubles. It didn't end the violence, not immediately. If you look later in that year, you had the Drumcree marches that ended tragically in the death of three Quinn boys when they were burnt out of their home by loyalist protesters. You had the Omagh bomb in August of that year, which was 29 people killed. And I think people looked into the abyss with those incidents. They saw what lay in store for them if they didn't actually rally around the agreement. And it has been the foundation stone. In the agreement that was struck between the EU and the UK just before Christmas, you see the Good Friday Agreement is written into that, the principles that underpin it. And it did establish a new assembly, but it also conferred a huge number of rights on people. And they were crucial in kind of cementing the peace that flowed from it.
Now, the 19th of January this year will be the 50th anniversary of the death of Alfred Chester Beatty, the mining magnate, philanthropist, businessman and avid collector known for the library in Dublin, which bears his name. Upon his death, his vast collection of manuscripts, miniature paintings, prints, drawings and rare books from around the world was bequeathed to a trust on behalf of the people of Ireland. Rona Tarrant went to the Chester Beatty Library and found out more.
Of all of the places for Chester Beatty to gift his extraordinary collection, Ireland was a somewhat unlikely choice. For one, Beatty was an American who spent much of his life in England. And apart from Irish grandparents on his father's side, he didn't have strong links to Ireland before he moved here at the age of 75. But in his will, Beatty gave the Irish state one of the most significant gifts it's ever received.
He assembled the most extraordinary collection.
Fionnuala Croke is the director of the Chester Beatty Library.
What was described as the finest collection in private hands of rare books and manuscripts and some decorative arts from all across Europe, the Islamic world, North Africa, Asia, right down into Southeast Asia.
Chester Beatty was born in New York City in 1875 and made his fortune as a mining engineer after he moved to Denver, Colorado.
We always say he began at the bottom as a mucker, literally mucking out in the mines. He got a foot on the ladder and, of course, very quickly he became manager of a mine. And then he came to the attention of the world's most famous mining engineer, as he was called, a man called John Hayes Hammond,
who gave Beatty a job as assistant manager of the Guggenheim Exploration Company in 1903.
He was very good at what he did, and he also made a lot of money because he was on a very good salary. So he was a very wealthy young man by the time he left them in 1908.
Beatty moved back to New York and bought a house on the Upper East Side.
His wife, Ninette, moved in, and their son, Chester Jr., was born there at the end of 1907. And he set up a consultancy on Broadway. He had an office on Broadway.
From the beginning, Beatty was collecting, and from his home he'd show off his rare and exotic finds.
Showing things like Japanese netsuke, Chinese snuff bottles. He was collecting some rare books, Western illuminated manuscripts, for example.
But a personal tragedy, the sudden death of his wife in 1911 from typhoid fever, prompted the next big move of his life the following year.
He moved with his brother Gedney and the two young children. He moved them all to London. He bought a home in Kensington Palace Gardens, Baroda House, and he set up his own company called Selection Trust, which went on to become a very large conglomerate with mining interests all over the world.
And it was here in London that he amassed his collection of rare artefacts and manuscripts. For example, his Christian manuscripts include the earliest surviving codex of all four Gospels and Acts in one book, and the earliest copy of the collection of St. Paul's letters.
He sort of applied the same criteria that you might think he used in the mining world to his collecting. He graded manuscripts, A, A1, A2, B and C.
By 1933, Beatty was a British citizen and a prominent figure in British life.
He was very close to Winston Churchill, and he had really done an awful lot for the war effort. He had given his home over twice, both during the First and the Second World Wars, as a Red Cross hospital. But he also served on a number of government committees.
But after the war, things began to change, and a series of events led Beatty to Ireland.
After the war, to his great shock, the Labour government was voted in with Clement Attlee as Prime Minister. That is really one of the great reasons that he felt, you know, the Labour policies were going to put an end to all sort of entrepreneurship and enterprise and business. Another reason that is mentioned time and again is that he had difficulty accessing foreign currency. And his son had bought a house in County Kildare in the 1940s, and he had visited his son on several occasions, and he really liked Ireland.
And so he made the third big move of his life in 1950, this time to Aylesbury Road in Dublin.
And he bought a site around the corner on Shrewsbury Road where he built his library. You know, within 12 months he was already opening his private library, as it was, to the public.
So why did he decide to give his vast, rare collection to Ireland? Well, when Beatty was thinking of his legacy, he knew he wanted his collection to be kept together.
He could have, for example, left it to one of the major museums in London. But I think he feared that it would kind of get divided up, or a lot of it might just lay in storage for many years.
And there was the fact that Beatty really liked Ireland.
So in his will, in the trust, he set up that the library was to be left for the use and enjoyment of the public.
Chester Beatty died on the 19th of January 1968 and was buried in Glasnevin Cemetery 50 years ago this month.
Rona Tarrant was reporting there from the Chester Beatty Library and finding out about some of the items in the collections of Alfred Chester Beatty. Catherine, those collections were a huge acquisition for this country, weren't they?
They absolutely were. I mean, we were incredibly lucky that Chester Beatty became disillusioned with life in the UK and moved here after the Second World War. He moved here. He loved Dublin. He said, I think in words we could all recognise, Dublin is most attractive and if the climate was better, I would live there all the year. And he was very concerned that those collections wouldn't be broken up, so he didn't want to give them to an institution, so he created his own. And an absolute treasure in the heart of Dublin, in the grounds of Dublin Castle now.
Jumping back 100 years to 1868, so the 150th anniversary, of the publication of the novel Little Women.
Yeah, so Louisa May Alcott came from a very interesting background. She was born to Transcendentalist parents. In May of that year of 1868, she writes in her diary that her publisher, she was writing sensational stories and largely as potboilers to keep them in funds. Her publisher had said to her there was a gap in the market for a story for girls and she didn't think she was going to make much of a job of it, but she would give it a go. The novel comes out on the 30th of September, so she banged out Little Women in 10 weeks. She created what could have been one of those improving stories for girls. I mean, there is a degree to which the Little Women, through sacrifice, learn how to grow into virtuous women. But really, in the story of the four March sisters, Meg and Jo and Beth and Amy, she created characters so engaging that they burst out of the strictures of that kind of novel and have been so enduring that the novel has never been out of print.
And nowadays, had she done this, there would have been Little Women 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, right up to Little Women 20 at least, I'm sure.
Yeah, so that's a proud tradition. She wrote Little Women in 1869. She brought out Good Wives and later on Joe's Boys and Little Men. So she continued the story of the Marches and their family and their extended families over quite a number of novels.
Okay, after the break, more significant and historic anniversaries that we're going to be marking in 2018.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.
Welcome back to the History Show here on RTE Radio 1, where we're looking at significant and interesting historical anniversaries coming up in 2018. My guests are Catherine McSharry, Mark Duncan and Daniel Geary. Dan, 1918 saw the outbreak of an influenza pandemic, which becomes known for fairly spurious reasons as the Spanish flu. It affected people around the world, but the first recorded outbreak was actually, I think, in the USA, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was a tremendously destructive event. I mean, more than half a million Americans died of it and, you know, millions more around the world. In fact, my great-grandfather died of the Spanish flu. And this is the funny thing, as we talk about anniversaries, I mean, part of what we're doing is saying, oh, well, this is, you know, well in the past. But I mean, 100 years ago really is, you know, it seems like ancient history in our, you know, modern media world, but it's really not that long ago that, you know, that I could have a great-grandfather who died in the Spanish flu. And obviously that would have affected my grandmother very much, and my mother and myself. So these historical events are still with us in a very real way.
Why was it called the Spanish flu?
Yeah, my understanding is that because of the war, they didn't want to report on the flu in the U.S. and the other countries. They didn't want people to be alarmed. So there was kind of a press ban, you know, because of the restriction on the freedom of the press during the war. But Spain was a neutral country. So, you know, they could report on Spain, and that gave people the impression that things were really bad in Spain, yeah. When in fact, I don't think they were any worse than anywhere else.
And did it start, would it appear that it began in Etaples in France, which was a huge staging post and also a huge hospital camp during the First World War?
I think that's quite possible. I think that wartime conditions made the flu far more deadly than it would have been otherwise. And unlike other, I mean, people do, of course, die from flu outbreaks even today, but you think of people whose immune systems are already compromised. But people like my great-grandfather, I mean, just in the prime of life, completely healthy, were dying from this flu in 1918, partly because the sort of general conditions of public health had eroded because of wartime conditions.
I think the mortality was something of the order of 20%, whereas the normal flu epidemic mortality is 0.1%. And Catherine, you had a relative who died from Spanish flu as well.
That's right. I mean, I think it demonstrates, in fact, how pervasive it was. My great-uncle died. My great-grandfather was fighting in the First World War. He got news he was in hospital. He'd been wounded by shrapnel. He got news that one of his little boys had died at home, and he was one of tens of millions worldwide and over 20,000 people in Ireland who died, which is a hugely, really extraordinarily large number for something that hasn't left quite the same memory as you would expect. For example, in November, in a day in November in 1918, before noon, there were 50 burials in Glasnevin Cemetery alone.
Mm. It's about 3 or 4%, I think, of the world's population died in this pandemic.
Yeah, one of the, Catherine's probably familiar with this individual, Martin Sheridan, was born in Bohola, one of the greatest athletes ever to come from Ireland. He competed in 3 Olympic Games, won medals in 3 Olympic Games, 9 medals in all, 5 gold, all in the colours of the United States. He was a member of the NYPD, died from pneumonia in the early months of 1918, and he was only 37 years of age, you know?
And extraordinarily fit, extraordinarily strong.
Absolutely. He was described by the New York Times as the greatest athlete this country has ever known. By this country, of course, they meant the United States.
Now, Catherine, we marked 100 years since the Russian revolutions of 1917 last year, but the execution of Nicholas II and his family didn't actually take place until 1918. Tell me what happened there.
That's right. So in the summer of 1918, there were a couple of things happened which made those executions in effect inevitable. There were anti-Bolshevik uprisings in various parts of Russia, particularly in Moscow, and there were pro-royal forces advancing on the Urals, where the Romanov family were being kept. In those circumstances, if you want to be clinical and ruthless, you don't want to keep around any figureheads who might be able to spearhead a counter-revolutionary movement. And so it was decided that Tsar Nicholas II and the Tsarina, their children, their retainers, were all to be executed. And they were. They were executed in July, and they were executed in a fairly gruesome way. And we know that from British intelligence reports subsequently that the bodies were burned, they were dumped in a mine shaft, they were doused in sulfuric acid, and there were somewhat piteous remains left: shoe buckles, corset ribs, diamonds and platinum crosses.
But there wasn't going to be any memorial of any kind or any place that white Russians could go to mourn the graves
exactly.
Or anything like that. Finally, Mark, another significant anniversary you've chosen takes us to 1978, as in November, it's 40 years since the launch of RTE2 television.
Well, I know, Miles, you have a great fondness for the West Coast of America, and the movie that was shown on the opening night of RTE2 was Bullet, with Steve McQueen, Robert Vaughn, Jacqueline Bisset.
Watch there's a great car chase, but it's count famous. The number of hubcaps, because he loses 5 hubcaps in the course of the car chase. Carry on, sorry.
Only 5?
Only 5.
The film followed, actually, a gala performance from the Cork Opera House, and the venue is probably appropriate because not just because Jack Lynch was Taoiseach at the time and would have been present on the evening, but also because Cork had a very strong lobby group which had been advocating for more access to British channels in the mid-1970s. They thought this was kind of discrimination, even though it had absolutely nothing to do with RTE providing them with access. That was merely a matter of geography, that people in the south of the country couldn't access British television. There had been moves towards creating a second channel in the mid-1970s. A broadcasting review committee had published in 1974 and advocated for one. Conor Cruise O'Brien, when he was the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs, I think in that coalition government, had suggested that the second channel would reproduce BBC One in return for RTE signal being available across the north of Ireland. That's not what happened, of course, but what you did get on that second channel was the best of British with new home-produced programming. RTE2 has always had a very great difficulty asserting a kind of an identity, and it probably still has, but it was more youth-driven, and there was an acknowledgement in RTE in the 1970s that they needed to provide more programme for youth. You saw that reflected in the establishment in 1979 of RTE2 Radio, which would provide for that market. But there are a series of innovations in the 70s. So you get RTE2 Television, RTE2 Radio, you get Radio na Gaeltachta, and of course you get the extension of colour television. So 1970s is when Ireland went from monochrome to colour.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. We've been looking at some of the major historical anniversaries that we'll be marking during 2018. My thanks tonight to Ciarán Dunn on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. My thanks to also to Dan Geary, to Mark Duncan and to Catherine McSharry. Until the same time next week, from me, Miles Duncan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.